level of timeless interest, enthusiasm for something like our breathing or our mindfulness meditation, just moment by moment. What's happening now? What's happening now? And to begin cultivating that interest, oh, this is the really interesting to do that. My breath or my moment-to-moment experience is so interesting. It actually has greater value than sitting here wondering about anti-wrinkle cream or wondering about car payments or wondering about, you know, what video to rent for tonight or whatever, you know, direction your mind might go, kind of, that seems so interesting in the moment. As our interest in our meditation, and we can feel more settled and committed, have more confidence that I'm going to sit here and be here in the present moment with this activity, with this focus, greater and greater interest comes and greater enthusiasm comes. It becomes kind of like a feedback loop. There's a healthy cycle. The greater the interest, the greater the joy. The greater the joy, the greater the interest. And so the joy that can arise sometimes in meditation sometimes is called rapture. And the Buddhist texts describe five different kinds of rapture you might experience in your meditation. There's minor joy or minor rapture. There's a momentary rapture. There's, I'm not sure how best translated, but cascading, or cascading maybe is the best word. Cascading, it feels like waves washing over you, one wave after the other. Just this wave, you know, it's like this huge, it's kind of like an orgasm to, you know, 10 degrees more strong, more, you know, 10 times stronger than an orgasm, because it's so thoroughly, there's waves of cascading, pounding, full bodily wave of just rapture and joy that just passes through the body. And then there can be transporting joy, the fourth kind, which it feels like you're being lifted off the ground. In the ancient texts, they say you actually are. You can actually fly different places when you have this level of joy. I don't know, but at least it feels that way. And then there can be the joy of, and then the last fifth one is all pervading. Just you feel like a, maybe you feel like a balloon which has been blown up to its capacity. You feel so filled with capacity, just bursting, ready to burst with delight. But whether it's that intense or whether it's just very kind of small, subtle joy, joy is a very important element of the path. But in order to feel joy, there has to be a sense that it's not only okay to feel it, but that it's appropriate to feel it, and that maybe it's there more often than you realize. And it's a matter of kind of looking for it, or relaxing, or opening to the possibility of it being there. Because when we're so consumed with our preoccupations, our preoccupations don't allow us any space in the mind to notice the joy that might be there. And there's a lot more joy in our lives than most people will admit or allow for. It doesn't take much to experience some joy for many people. I know maybe this is a dramatic example, but yesterday I went to the beach with my son. And we had this wonderful time on the beach together, and then I put him in the car seat, and I sat in the front seat of the car. And for some reason, he was really content sitting there. And I gave him his cracker. He was eating his cracker, and he was content to be left alone for a while. And I was all concerned about making sure he was happy and everything. And there was this movement of becoming, this movement of preoccupation and concern, and it was a cycle of my reactivity to him. He has to be happy, and I have to make him happy and make sure he's well fed. And because if I don't, then he's going to want even more from me. And I was like a little bit preoccupied in this world of taking care of him. You know, it's a cyclic world of parenting. And it took me a while to realize that he was basically didn't need anything from me. And probably could have realized a little bit earlier. But I was like, in my cycles, right? And finally, wait a minute, wow, he doesn't need anything. Let me just sit here and relax in the driver's seat and look out at the ocean. And all this joy was right there. You know, it wasn't very far away. All I had to do was stop my preoccupation with his happiness. And it was there. Just, wow. At the ocean, looking at the big waves. So I don't know if that was a good example for you, but... So I thought of talking about this today because I had noticed that I, in 1 week, 3 weeks ago, I talked about suffering, and the following week I talked about faith or trust or confidence. And then I remembered actually that's the beginning of these 12 steps towards freedom that the Buddha laid out, the process towards freedom. That's the alternative to the process of, the cyclic process of becoming and suffering. So then I'll talk a little bit about joy, delight and joy. And then I thought I would better explain where it comes from, why I'm doing it now. So that's my thoughts for today. I didn't cover joy and delight very well, but you're not going to be preoccupied by that, are you? But we have 5 minutes if you want to react or have comments or questions to what I said. Yes?
I'm working with loving kindness meditation lately. I was wondering if the difference between may I be happy or the affirmation, kind of new age of I am happy, had anything to do with what you're talking about now? I'm seeing some kind of maybe connection, or why do we say may I be instead of I am?
So I could feel joy just the fact that she asked that question. Oh, she wants to know the difference between the Buddhist loving kindness meditation, where the phrase is "May I be happy," versus what she called the New Age practice of affirmation, where you say "I am happy."
Seems like it's related somewhat to what you're saying. Like, I am happy. I'm not at this moment, so you just strive for.
Right. So she says, it seems to be related, and I then kind of sidestepped the question immediately by. Just point, you taking an opportunity to point out that, see, I could have been very preoccupied with her answer, and with my sense of becoming, oh, I better please her, I better have a wise answer, or you know, all these people are listening. I'm supposed to be his teacher, you know, and in order to be a teacher, I better kind of have a good answer for all of you, and that's a cycle of becoming. I need to become something and create something, a good answer, and that just creates more suffering to do that kind of way. Or I could just kind of. Take a moment and relax, not to be preoccupied by that. And notice, that's a great question. And the fact that, that there's a human being who is interested in that kind of question actually brings delight to me. I mean, wow, someone who trying to explore this issue of loving kindness and happiness and how it comes about, and it's great. So I take the opportunity to feel more joy in the question than I do in how good this answer is. So, but you're still waiting for an answer.
Not very well.
So the difference between an affirmation, I am happy, and may I be happy. It might be that you are happy, and being reminded of that by an affirmation might be the really wise thing to do. I mean, I think there tends to be more happiness under the surface if we just turn to it than sometimes we realize. If we're really preoccupied sometimes. But the movement of affirmation sometimes, and the reason I distrust it, is because sometimes, not always, it tends to be an overlay of a demand. This is the way things should be. And sometimes it does change our consciousness, and we can feel happier as a result. But it tends to be a happiness which is all too easily kind of a superficial overlay on top of the actual movements of our psychology. And Buddhism tends to focus more on understanding what our reactive psychology in a deeper way, so we can uproot it once and for all, rather than to overlay a nice veneer over it. Loving kindness practice, may I be happy, it gets born out of some confidence that, yeah, it's possible to be happy. I might not be happy right now. It's possible to be happy. And it's a really beautiful thing to have that intention that I'd be happy. I don't know if I'm going to... It's kind of like... The may I be happy intention is kind of like... Buddhism doesn't say this because it's not a theistic religion, but it's kind of like saying, may I be happy, God willing. You know, it's like the intention is there, and that intention is very powerful. It plants a seed, which gives fruit. But we don't know when. That intention is a beautiful thing in and of itself. And if you properly understood, to have that intention for your own happiness can bring happiness itself. You want to be happy, but the desire for the intention, when done wisely, is a happiness-producing state of mind. So sometimes, if you say, may I be happy, when I say, may I be happy, sometimes my happiness is just right there. And I just feel all this happiness just in the moment. That's all it took, was to say, may I be happy, may I wish for that happiness to be there. And sometimes it's not there, but the fact that I'm practicing and fueling, or in a sense, or feeding the intention, may I be happy, conditions me in the future for that happiness to be more likely to arise and to surface. So the loving kindness practice is strengthening an intention. The affirmation is kind of an overlay. And the intention, I think, if it's not, hopefully with the loving kindness, it's strengthening an intention which is sincere. May I am happy as an affirmation may or may not be sincere. It may be, born out of tremendous aversion of your state of being. So, okay, I am happy no matter what. You know, or so. So is that approaching an acceptable answer?
I was just wondering if the one brief cycle of becoming is just when we're talking.
It's a little bit awkward to say this, but they both create cycles of becoming. Loving kindness meditation also creates a cycle of becoming, but it's a healthier cycle. You can participate in the cycle of becoming in healthier and unhealthier ways. And there are healthy ways, they still perpetuate the cycle of becoming and creation and becoming. But loving kindness participates in the cycle, but it tends to create a healthier cycle. And it's possible they're really healthy cycles with a lot of happiness and joy in it, but it's still cyclical, and it's not the same thing as freedom. But the loving kindness, as it creates a healthier cycle, makes for a much better jumping off place for freedom to happen. Yes?
Can you say something about how the concept of right action fits together with this notion of unbecoming?
Oh. Maybe it ties to what I just said now, that in the cyclic world of becoming, we can create maybe it's like the cyclic world is like a cylinder rather than a hoop. And on that, and we go around and around in the cylinder. And if we down at the bottom of the cylinder is like in a can, right? And down the can, it's all rusted and kind of sharp and painful. And as you get near the top where it's been kind of above the moisture or whatever, it's really smooth and shiny and just like you can just kind of put your ice skates on and just kind of skate around really easily. Really, happily. But you're still in a which are wholesome, which are skillful, which are conducive towards going up higher in that cylinder. And unwholesome actions are conducive to going down to where the rust and the sharp corners are and stuff. Maybe to say it differently, that the choices we make of how we're going to choose to act have consequences. And if we choose to act out of hate, that tends to, when the circle comes around again, what goes around comes around, they say, right? So if we act out of hate, it tends to condition further suffering and further habit formations of hate. It tends to drop us in lower level on the cylinder. If we act out of love, what comes around goes around. What goes around comes around. So if we act on love, it comes around again to further becoming, but we tend to float up to the top of the cylinder where it's really nice. We're still in the cylinder. Freedom is getting off the cylinder. It's easier to get off the cylinder if you're not at the bottom with all the rust and all that where it's all really difficult. So right action is the action that tends to help us create the conditions so that it's easier for us to step off. So for example, if you just did a whole bunch of awful things last week, just did a lot of terrible things, or were lost, consumed in desire and ambition, or consumed with hate and ill will towards everyone else around you, just consumed in all this stuff. When you sit down to meditate, that momentum is still there. It's very hard to see, oh, I have a different choice. It just seems so compelling to be filled with hate or ambition. But if you choose to act out of more love and out of more generosity, then when you sit down to meditate, that love and generosity probably hasn't created the same force of preoccupation. And it's going to be a lot easier to see, oh, it's possible to respond to this in a non-reactive way. And therefore, and then stepping off the cycles of reactivity. Does it make some sense?
It makes some sense, but it seems to make the goal inaction.
The goal in action. The goal is. I thought you said in action. In acting. Oh yeah. The goal is in action. The goal is, in a sense, is to know that there is a possibility to know, to experience the unfabricated, the unmade aspect of reality, unmade, unfabricated mind. That does not lead us to become passive, but rather leads us to actions, to activity in the world, which is not tainted by anything extra. Any sense of ego, of any sense of wanting to become something, any sense of trying to create something for the mind. There's no, as some people say, there's no traces in the action. There's no traces of ego. So people who are enlightened still go around doing all kinds of stuff. You know, they go pee and eat their food and help other people and do different things. But there's nothing extra about it. And there's an unfabricated aspect to it. There's a presence there. Kind of like there's a sense of there's a presence that they're at home in, which doesn't require them to be anything for anyone, including for themselves. But to discover that presence, it's helpful to create healthy conditions, like the delight, the delight that arises out of feeling your own integrity, creates healthy conditions that makes it a lot easier than to step out of the cycle of reactivity into that unfabricated presence. And how you choose to act, once you're in that unfabricated presence, that's up to you. Buddhism doesn't tend to give a prescription of how you're supposed to be once you're there.
Maybe your cylinder is more like a cup.
Maybe. So this is... This teaching I kind of did very briefly today is considered to be a very profound part of Buddhist teaching and Buddhist practice. And if it didn't make any sense because I covered it too quickly or too simplistically, I apologize. And if it confused you, just it was very valuable to grapple with it and try to understand it better. If it confused you, but if it really bugs you, then just leave it here. So thank you for your listening so carefully.